Okay, so well, thanks to the organisers, as per usual, for inviting me to come to the workshop. And this talk's going to be slightly different in the sense of I'm not really focusing on formalism. It's actually looking more at possible implications. And again, not so much directly of the path integral, but just about some of the ideas that we have about quantum processes in gravity using a semi-classical approach. So just to note my collaborators, mostly this is work done with Ian Moss, but also with various students and postdocs. So here are sort of few archive references. It's quite a short talk, and I've got to keep the speaker to time, so I'll keep one eye on it. And basically, the whole sort of theme of this talk is how dependent are some of our sort of classic results on the sort of very idealized symmetry that go into compute doing the calculations. So that's really what this is about. Just to emphasize, since we have had quite a few talks in the workshop about formalism, I'm going to be doing a fairly sort of naive type of sort of bog standard semi-classical approach to computing these tunneling amplitudes, and that it is the sort of standard calculating actions of Euclidean solutions to field theory. What's slightly different is the breaking of the symmetry with black holes, and mostly what I'll do here is keep it analytic as far as possible, but then I'll just sort of summarize the results of some numerical work that we've done and what it means for primordial black holes. So the starting point or the rationale here is the fact that it seems as if we calculate the running of the Higgs self-coupling, something interesting happens given the mass of the Higgs as measured at the LHC. So we could be in an entirely stable vacuum. We know we're not in a fully unstable vacuum, but it seems as if we have this, if we run to very high energies, it looks as if the Higgs self-coupling becomes negative. Now, yeah, okay, so there's caveats to that, but I'm simply presenting this as kind of a motivation to re-examine vacuum decay. And so we have this picture that whereas at sort of our standard model energies, we have our friendly sort of usual Higgs potential, but at very high energies, the potential reverses and becomes negative so that our universe may not be entirely stable. So the reason why, when this was noticed, phenomenologists weren't too worried was that if you did your standard calculations, which we know of as Kalman-Delucia, it indicated that the half-life of the decay was way, way longer than the age of the universe, so it seemed reasonable not to worry about it. So even if there was metastability, the thought was it doesn't matter. And, you know, that's basically what I want to query in this talk. So again, I just put one slide on the sort of Euclidean trick just to recall the approach or the philosophy behind the calculations that we're doing. And I guess I'm not sure I regard this as really rotating in time. I think of it more as a calculational tool. We want to try and get an amplitude, a probability for a decay process. And in order to calculate that, it's kind of easiest to do it through this rotating to a Euclidean time, inverting the potential, and looking for a classical solution. So that's the sort of idea, that's the procedure. And so, you know, it's a short talk, so I'm just summarizing very quickly. So the reason for doing it this way is it gives an easy, direct way of computing tunneling probabilities that generalize to field theory. So it's a pragmatist's approach. What happens, we can actually use these classical Euclidean solutions that we get, rotate back to Lorentzian time, and we get the picture of a bubble that suddenly appears and then expands, thereby decaying from our false vacuum to the true vacuum. So Coleman originally developed this process during the 70s and early 80s, and this was the picture there of the formation of the bubble, and he described it by a Euclidean solution, as I was saying, that goes from the false to the true vacuum, the lower energy state, and he looks for a solution of the Euclidean equations, which we can write down. And then he came up with this sort of very intuitive thin wall description that you'd have this bubble of real vacuum surrounded by a very thin wall, which is where you'd be going over the barrier between the real and the false vacuum. And then outside you'd have the false vacuum. And so obviously you can solve these Euclidean equations directly, usually numerically, but his idea was, let's just say it's roughly a thin wall, which is roughly, people knew how to do this, roughly a domain wall. And so you go ahead, you say, well, if I go from false to true vacuum, I gain energy. So I have a sort of energy gain, but I have to make the wall, and that's an energy deficit. And then you kind of balance these two out. You make your action stationary. And so you end up with some value for the Euclidean action, this action of the bounce. And then that gives you the tunneling probability by exponentiation. So you can, by looking at the Euclidean equations, you can sort of justify this thin wall approach that Coleman took. So that's the sort of picture. But of course, that was just in field theory. Energy gravitates, so we have to add gravity to the picture. And of course, we know that our de Sitter space in the, I'm basically going to focus for the talk on tunneling from a false positive cosmological constant to a true zero cosmological constant, because the pictures are easier. That's not what we did. You know, we looked at them all, but pictures are easier. So de Sitter space from a Lorentzian perspective is a hyperboloid. From a Euclidean perspective, it's a sphere. And so if this is de Sitter space, what we need to do is to tunnel to true vacuum, which is flat. So we're going to have to cut our sphere and replace it with just a flat surface. So that's the idea geometrically. That's what we do with Einstein gravity. It's just geometry. And so Coleman de Lucia showed how to do this within the context of Euclidean Einstein gravity. And it's sort of fairly familiar formalism to people working in GR. You use these Israel junction conditions, which represent this thin wall. And these actually determine the wall radius, which in Coleman's original picture was found by a sort of variational principle, finding the sort of right size of the bubble. Then you just calculate the Euclidean action, the Euclidean-Einstein action now, of this instanton solution, and subtract the background de Sitter action. And that's how you get your tunneling amplitude. So this is the picture of Coleman de Lucia's instanton. Your original, was that a question or a stretch?
As soon as you saw it, I thought so. Yeah. I was wondering, is there any difference here from standard Coleman de Lucia in the sense that the other side of the barrier here is supposed to be at high energy? The potential is supposed to turn around at high energy?
Oh,
are you tunneling to...
So at the moment, I was just sort of going over the standard Coleman de Lucia type argument within the context of de Sitter to flat. Yeah.
Is it different for the Higgs?
So I guess not really. I mean, I guess...
It's not given at fixed energy. It's given...
Sorry?
Potential is not given at fixed energy. You say the potential becomes...
negative.
Because the coupling runs of energy. So how do you You see what my puzzle is?
I'm not quite sure I do see what the question is.
The region
is.
Where the potential has turned around and is becoming small again, the other side of the barrier, is supposed to only occur at high energy.
Yes.
But they claim that energy is parameterized by the Higgs boson.
Yeah.
So that would just be a stand-in for the energy, the field value.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. They don't mean literally.
But then when you're on the other side, would you have a high energy?
No, a large Higgs value.
Well, you'd have a large Higgs expectation value, which means everything would be. The laws of physics would be different, so to speak.
Okay. I think there's something there I don't understand.
Well, it might be I used a word.
I mean this identification of the field value with the energy.
Well, you see, you're computing an effective potential, so you're supposed to put zero momentum on the external lines.
Right.
And the only measure of the energy is that this expands itself.
Okay. All right, thanks.
Okay. So I guess, let's see, I was trying not to have too many equations, so this is why I was drawing the pictures, which may have backfired. But this is just the sort of standard 1981 picture of decay from de Sitter to flat space. So this is what the geometry looks like, and that's kind of what, you know, that was the story, that's the process, procedure that people used when first trying to figure out, do we have to worry about the stability of our actual Higgs vacuum? So that was the instanton that was computed. Okay. So the question that we simply asked, or rather, it's not that it hadn't been asked before, but the one that we sort of looked at carefully was what happens if this idealized picture is just that? It's not actually what happens. What happens if you've got some inhomogeneity, something that's dirty? You know, do you have sort of, you know, this was really the sort of picture. If we put something, some impurity in our system, does it change the probability of vacuum decay? So without wanting to lose too much of the analyticity, with the easiest way to break the symmetry is to just break one lot of symmetry, to go from O4 to a sort of SO3 type of, SO3-1 type of symmetry by putting a black hole. So our picture now is we've got a false vacuum with a black hole. Then we get a bubble which may or may not have a black hole inside of it. So that's the sort of basic picture. Mathematically, from the perspective of looking at the Euclidean Einstein equations, it's actually not that different because there's still sufficient symmetry to know exactly what the background solutions can be and to know what the bubble wall solutions can be. So we haven't lost so much symmetry that we don't know the general solutions. We still know that our general solution is indeed a Schwarzschild, Schwarzschild de Sitter, Schwarzschild ADS, with a wall at fixed distance from the black hole.
So that's assuming that the horizon and the bubble walls are concentric?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Why?
So, well, this is what kind of comes out if you look at the. So you kind of tend to start by thinking about the wall and looking at the solutions on and off the wall. And so what you don't want, or what we didn't want, was for those just to be simple vac or Einstein manifolds. We didn't want just de Sitter or anti-de Sitter or flat. We wanted to have something that was nonetheless consistent with the symmetries of the wall, but had some Riemann, some non-trivial Riemann curvature. So if you ask for that, it's basically the same problem that was looked at when doing brain worlds and brain world cosmology. So you know that the solution is a sort of Schwarzschild type of
Birkhoff's theorem.
It's a generalization of a Birkhoff theorem, yes, precisely. So it's relaxing a little bit symmetry, yeah. but that's where it's coming from. Yeah. So in a sense, it's because you start with the wall and then you see that they're exactly concentric. If you don't make them concentric, then you've really got your work cut out for you trying to find the trajectory. Okay, so the gravitational problem is actually not that much more difficult. The equations are just as simple as with Kullmann-De Lucia. It's just that the potential or the sort of exact coefficients sort of change just slightly. And so to solve, usually you just pop it on you ask Mathematica to do it just for convenience rather than necessity. Same procedure, you find the solution, you calculate the action of the instanton. The only technical feature, which I probably won't have time to talk about, but it's happy to if someone wants to question me about it, is a technicality to do with dealing with conical singularities. But this is the net result, which is essentially saying there's two parts of the action. There's a part that's pure geometry. It's like it's sort of entropy difference between the initial black hole state and the final black hole state, if there is one. Then there's a bit that depends on the trajectory of the bubble. If the bubble depends on time, Euclidean or otherwise, this piece is here. But you can have static bubbles that just sort of sit there, and then this piece disappears. So that's sort of basically walking through the process. So our general solution, general instanton, has a black hole remnant, so a black hole inside the bubble, and of course a black hole seed, the black hole that initially catalyzed the decay. For any seed, the sort of structure is you get time-dependent solutions that are like Kullmann-De Lucia, seeded by a black hole but with no remnant inside, or static solutions with seeds and remnants. And that's basically what this bit is saying. And then, of course, between the two, there's a special value of critical mass where there's no remnant but it's static. So the sort of net result is you find these solutions, and there's a whole range of solutions with actions below that of the Kullmann-De Lucia bounce. Now, this plot is just meant to sort of be indicative. It's not physically realistic values. It's just ones that work easily with Mathematica numerics. So the gist is whether you start tunneling from positive cosmological constant to zero or negative, from zero to negative, from whatever, it's all pretty similar. Here we start off with Kullmann-De Lucia. We add a tiny seed mass. We get a sort of tweaked Kullmann-De Lucia, but with no remnant black hole. We get this critical solution with no remnant but is static. And then all the way up here, these ones are static bubbles with remnant black holes. There are also solutions that are time dependent with a remnant, but those have higher action. So this line follows the lowest action solution for each seed mass. So this is just sort of an indicator. So what's the fate of the black hole? If we have a black hole in the universe and there is an metastability of the vacuum, what happens? It's not just that we can see vacuum decay, because black holes also radiate, so they are also evaporating. So we have to kind of check which process wins out. So we're using an old result of Dom Page that says your sort of typical evaporation rate looks like 1 over m cubed. So this is the sort of rough sort of rate at which the black hole loses mass by evaporation. And then we've got our tunneling rate, the probability that the black hole catalyzes one of these decays. So we have to compare the two. Now, we can do this at least crudely by an estimate, because the for static solutions, which are the ones for larger mass, the action is simply a change in the entropy. It's the difference in the areas of the horizons. And so we can represent that as sort of M, m plus squared minus m minus squared is simply the sort of average mass times the difference in masses. And although it's not at all obvious unless you actually find a solution, it turns out that the difference in mass between the seed and the remnant doesn't change much as you go, you know, as you sort of drop the seed mass of the black hole. So roughly speaking, more or less, the action of the bubble is going like something that's not changing much with m times m. So you get a prefactor that's roughly e to the minus m times a number, sorry, exponential factor, and the prefactor is roughly m to the 5/2. So you look at what then the ratio of the decay rate to evaporation rate, and you get a shape that's something like this. So you know that for larger mass black holes, evaporation will dominate, if it dominates at all, but as the black hole shrinks, the decay rate becomes more prominent. And so the question is, where is the line of equality? Do we actually get to the point where evaporation is more probable than the black hole, sorry, where decay is more probable than evaporation? And so for these thin wall black holes, sorry, thin wall instantons, we find that indeed, if we look at sort of various different ways, different relatively realistic parameters, we see that the decay becomes more likely than evaporation when we get sort of within spitting distance of the Planck mass. So it's still above the Planck scale, but not much, not enough to be comfortable. But it's basically saying you have to have tiny black holes for this to even be an issue. So primordial black holes are the obvious candidate for tiny black holes. They have a temperature above the CMB, so they will evaporate over time. So eventually they could become light enough that they hit this danger range. Now, I have to say the thin wall calculations are analytic, but not realistic. The parameter values take us too close to the Planck scale to really have confidence in this semi-classical approach. But it does give a proof of principle. So what we then did was to go and thicken the wall. So essentially, without this term, this would be what you get from the standard model. So this was what sort of phenomenology people were calculating. In order to get a thin wall, you had to sort of add an ad hoc extra term proportional to phi to the 6 to kind of give yourself a stabilizing point in the potential. So this was the term that gave the thin wall approximation. So all we do is kind of tune this and turn off this piece gradually. So that's kind of, this is meant to represent the notion of a thin wall would be a step function, and you thicken it and it starts to look more like, a bit like a tanche. So we didn't want to do this for the exact running of the coupling. So what we did instead was modeled this lambda effective by a sort of log squared and log to the fourth term so that we could cover parameter space of the standard model and a bit beyond. So the two-loop calculation is this gray line, and these red dashed lines are our sort of rough fitting. Well, it's not rough, it's actually not bad, are fitting the actual Higgs potential. So it allows us to sort of pan round parameter space. So here's the sort of standard model range. So these are three are examples with the top mass running between 172 and 174 GeV. And we sort of panned around in this area and also away from a sort of standard model range. And so this roughly is what we got. We first checked the thin wall by increasing this lambda 6. This is pure standard model. This is standard model with ad hoc corrections. And you see that if this was the thin wall, we turn off this ad hoc correction, and the problem becomes even more acute. So the thicker the wall, the more prominent the decay is, or the more likely the decay is. So this is just a result of scanning through different parameter, sort of varying our fit. And you can sort of see it's all sort of fairly consistent. You know, the log terms don't make such a big difference. It's actually the negative phi to the fourth term that's the biggest sort of factor. But you can see here we're sort of 10 to the 7 Planck masses. So these are decent-sized black holes. You certainly would, if you believe the semi-classical approach at all, you would believe it here. And so our picture is, or our claim is, again, subject to sort of agreeing with this semi-classical approach, is that if we have primordial black holes, then although they sort of start out with a larger mass, they will evaporate, they'll lose mass, until gradually they start coming down to sort of a billion or so Planck mass size, and at that point they become small enough that they will catalyze one of these decays. So we can kind of view this, if you like, as a constraint on primordial black holes, or just suggesting that this isn't actually what happens to the Higgs potential. So just to sum up, I've at least given an overview of the work we've done to say that if we have this instability or better stability of the Higgs vacuum, then we can construct an instanton, which includes a black hole, to describe our decay process. And the black hole strongly enhances the probability of decay. And with a sort of very, like, sort of 10 to the 9 Planck mass black hole, so what about a ton? Then that's sort of small enough to actually seed one of these decay processes. Moreover, because you're talking about a black hole that's 10 to the 9 Planck masses, the typical evaporation rate associated with that is sort of well under sort of order, what, 10 to the minus 15, 10 to the minus 20 seconds. Once you get into this region in which tunneling is more probable, then it happens very, very quickly. So the bubble forms around the black hole, and then it expands. So it's very efficient for small black holes, and sort of indicates that, you know, that there's a tension between primordial black holes and metastability of the vacuum. So fair to say, though, of course, caveats to it. It's a big ask to believe the running of the Higgs coupling to the, you know, all to such high scales. I think there's also issues primordial black holes. It seems, you know, I know they coming around, going around, but, you know, it's again another step that you've got to take to accept them. And then finally, even if we did have these two ingredients, we'd still have to have the new phase percolating. So it would depend on, it's not saying there can't be primordial black holes, it just depends on how many. Maybe it's happened at the other side of the universe. Anyway, I shall stop because the chair is telling me it's time. Well, okay. Sorry, I was just about to take a question from Stefan. But,
yeah, I just wanted to, could you give an intuitive explanation? Maybe you did, I missed it. Why this effect is more prominent for small black holes? Because if you have none at all, then it's this astronomically long time.
Yeah, I think we sort of, you know, if you think of it as like the local curvature in a sense. It's sort of giving a, making it easier to, in a way, it's one of the ways of thinking about it. Sorry.
Yes, I looked in the past at bubbles that would help the cosmological constant to decay.
Mm-hmm.
Not really, well, it's very similar to the Coleman, the Lucha thing, but it's a bit simpler if one has a three-form field that changes across the surface, but that's just a technicality. And we worked it out in detail for spherical symmetry, but one criticism to ourselves was always that the bubble had to form all around the black hole at once, and that would seem very improbable. I mean, you see, it's very non-local.
Well, but the bubble forming at any place forms all at once. So,
but
yeah.
You say that it has to have the, quote, the black hole inside.
Inside.
So that's a lot. I mean, it's not...
But it's not more, I mean, in fact, it's not more than just forming even with vacuum inside. So...
Well, it is more because it...
Could
it
form
on the edge?
Yeah.
It's what, sorry?
Could it form on the edge?
Well, that's, you mean without the symmetry.
Yeah.
So, I'm not saying it can't, but in that sense, so the one thing that you gain by making, centering it on the black hole is the simplicity of the calculation. You can still do it because there's still enough symmetry that it's relatively straightforward. If you want to form, if you want to sort of completely break symmetries and split the black hole off, then the bubble is going to be deformed and, you know, for sure you can give it a whirl, but I mean, I think you have to do that numerically, completely numerically, even for a thin wall. Yeah, but it's still not quite enough, yeah. So
how big is the bubble compared to the black hole?
So it's usually, I don't have plots on this because it's a shorter one. So it's not an awful lot bigger, typically. And in some sense, that's why you need these very small black holes, because, you know, forming such, if you had a bigger black hole, forming a bigger bubble would be simply too expensive. So you do need the small black holes. But I think the other, if you think about it as the energy balance between the area of the bubble and the interior, it's sort of almost as if having a black hole inside has dropped, probably increased the volume in the sense of you get more of an energy gain from dropping from false to true vacuum. Because what you see is once the black, if you look at the sort of tweaked Coleman-de-Lucias, what happens is as you add a tiny black hole, the interior has no remnant and the bubble is slightly smaller. So you lose the black hole and your bubble shrinks a little compared to Coleman-de-Lucia. So it's almost as if the black hole changes the energy budget for, you know, the balance, yeah, between the balance of the energy you gain by falling out of the false vacuum and the energy you lose from making the bubble. So that seems to be how it works.
I understand, but if you have a large black hole,
then it's very unlikely.
Right.
Then it's very unlikely, yes. Mm-hmm. So I think the chair is suggesting we move on to the next speaker.